John Searle is one of the most influential philosophers of the second half of the 20th century, renowned for his contribution to philosophy of mind and the philosophy of language. John, you have proposed terms such as biological naturalism and irreducible subjective ontology. Can we use these to marry dualism with materialism when we study consciousness?
Okay, well, in the question you say I'm trying to marry dualism with materialism, and what I'm trying to do is reject both. I think the problem with this whole subject is we have these obsolete categories of materialism and dualism and monism and all the rest of it. And I think that's the difficulty. You have to, if we didn't have this peculiar history, I think it would be much easier to see the solution to the problem. If we never had a history of God, the soul, and immortality, and if we just had a sort of scientific view of the world, if we had our current science but without our current ideological history, then I think people would think it would be seem perfectly natural to suppose that consciousness is a biological phenomenon along with digestion. I think that's the right attitude. It's the difficulty is that there are two traditions that militate against that. One is the tradition of religion that says God, the soul, and immortality are not part of the physical world, and consequently consciousness is not part of the physical world because it's the soul, it's the feature of the soul. That's the Cartesian tradition. Now, there's another tradition that thinks it's opposed to that but accepts the worst assumptions, and that's the tradition of materialism that says, well, consciousness is not a part of the physical world. They both make the same mistake, and I think the best is to get rid of the vocabulary of dualism and materialism and mental and physical and just state the facts. The facts are that there are these conscious processes and states. They have a certain qualitative feel to them, that for every conscious state, there's something it feels like to be in that state. And consequently, they have what I call a first-person ontology, so they're different from other features of the world, like mountains and molecules, in that they only exist insofar as they're experienced by some eye, by a first person, by a subject, animal or human. Now, if we adopt that view, that just seems to me a natural view. I call it naturalism. And if the right level to investigate consciousness is at the biological level, as opposed to, say, the molecular level or the social level. So I've invented this artificial term, biological naturalism, to try to get out of the traditional, the traditions of dualism and materialism and all of that. So that I came by this term, biological naturalism, because I discovered that people feel more comfortable if your view has a name, if you can call it, and I reject all the usual names of materialism and monism and dualism. So let's treat consciousness as part of nature. The right level to investigate it is biological, and so a natural word for that seemed to be biological naturalism.
I agree with you, and I understand fully what you're saying in terms of Cartesian dualism and this kind of qualitative feel that we have with consciousness has been misinterpreted throughout history as being some kind of soul or consciousness independent of the brain and the mind. But if we're looking to define and reduce these qualitative experiences to a biological functioning, then can't we also reduce this biological functioning to materialism, as in it's a property of material phenomena in the brain? So
if you like, it's a property of the brain, but it's not materialism in the traditional sense, because materialism in the traditional sense denies the existence of any subjective ontology, anything that has a first-person existence. And I think you just have to face up to the fact that conscious states are qualitative states of humans and animals. Maybe there are other forms of consciousness, but the kinds that we know are humans and animals, and we have to accept that that's irreducible. Now, why is it irreducible? Why can't we say, well, we get rid of it the way we have with the sunsets or rainbows? And the answer to that is that you can't make the reality-illusion distinction for the very existence of consciousness, because if it consciously seems to you that you are conscious, then you are conscious. See, the illusion reality distinction is a distinction between how things consciously seem. It seems like the sun is setting over the mountains, and how they really are. It really isn't setting over the mountains. But you can't do that distinction for the very existence of conscious states, because where their existence is concerned, if the illusion of being conscious, the conscious illusion of being conscious is consciousness. There, you can't make the illusion reality distinction. So consciousness is unusual among biological phenomena, but that doesn't make it any less biological. It's a feature of our biological life caused by brain processes and realized in the brain.
You've just explained why it is called biological naturalism, because it isn't reducing it down to a materialistic sense in a historical tradition, which makes perfect sense. Now, yeah. I'm assuming that at this point, how you're defining consciousness with this internal subjective ontology obviously relates to your biological naturalism, and I'm assuming at this point that this is also going to play into how you feel about the hard problem.
Well, I think the expression hard problem is a misnomer. I mean, there's some debate about who invented it. I think it was probably Galen Strawson. But there is a difficult problem in neurobiology, and that is to figure out exactly how it works. That is, what exactly are the neurobiological processes that cause conscious states? Now, I think that the there's no metaphysical hardness to the problem. It's just a very hard to investigate a system consisting of 100 billion neurons and God knows how many synapses. Mm. And what makes it exceptionally difficult in the case of consciousness is it looks like you're going to have to identify global features of the brain, because what the brain does is not create just this or that perceptual experience. It creates an entire conscious field. And most of the existing research is on specific modalities. So you study gestalt switching, or you study pains, or you study the blind side. You study specific sorts of conscious experiences that people have. But the trouble with all that research is that it goes on in patients that are already conscious, and we need to know, how does the patient get the conscious field in the first place? So what I'm proposing is we shouldn't think of perception as creating consciousness, but as modifying a pre-existing conscious field. And the problem is to figure out how the brain creates the conscious field. Now, you might say, well, let's get busy and do it. The difficulty is that the current research techniques either rely on imaging or they rely on single cell recordings. There are others, but those are the most common research techniques. And neither of them gives us these global features that we need to get. We need to figure out how global features of the brain create a conscious field in the first place, which perception can then modify. And the difficulty here is that our research techniques just aren't advanced enough for this. I mean, I think we're getting better research techniques all the time, and as they develop, we should presumably be able to address the problem more directly than we can now.
But now, you touched upon the aspects of we have to go past perception and see what this consciousness is being experienced. And do you believe that there is a unified conscious experience that we have internally? So there is a Tony that I experience, and there is a John that you experience. Can I just have some of your thoughts, say, against Dan Dennett's position of fame in the brain, which is the unified you is a different kind of illusion, not the kind of illusion that you've just refuted previously 5 minutes ago, but a different kind of illusion of just different brain parts activating together, and the one that wins out is the kind of experience you have in the morning. So when we get up in the morning, we're supercharged with caffeine, we're alert versions of ourselves. But when we wake up in the middle of the night, half asleep, we're different versions of ourselves. So how do you feel about that perspective that says that even the unified experience isn't really you?
Well, there's no question that my ordinary waking experience, the kind I'm having right now, is unified in the sense that I don't just see the computer screen in front of me and hear the sound of my voice and feel the weight of my body against the chair, but I have all those simultaneously as part of a single field. Now, it's true, when I'm dreaming, everything's become disordered in various ways, but all the same, even in dreams, my dream is a single unified consciousness. It just doesn't have the detailed features of normal waking consciousness. So I don't buy the story that somehow or other we don't have a unified conscious field. We do. It's our daily experience. Now, there are various illusions. So, for example, there are various kinds of mistakes that we can make about the character of our conscious field. I mean, there is the various gaps in the experience that we don't detect, saccadic movement of the eyes and things like that. But there isn't any question that consciousness comes to us, normal waking consciousness comes to us in unified conscious field. And the various details, like the details I'm perceiving now, these are better thought of as modifications of the conscious field. Now, when last time I read Dennett, he was denying the existence of any subjective consciousness. He thinks we're mistaken in thinking we have that. And I think that, frankly, his view, I think, is frankly
simply preposterous.
I'm kind of in between the two. I see exactly what you're saying, and there, even if there are remote parts of the brain working separately in different modalities, we're still experiencing a unified internal state. So even now, if I start drinking alcohol, I might become obviously less able to speak or concentrate, but I'm still experiencing a unified Tony that's going on right now.
I mean, even if you get drunk or you ski so fast and you get in an ecstatic state, all the same, you have all that as part of a unified conscious field.
I do feel that Dennett's position is a bit too deterministic, and I don't really think that everything consciously is an illusion, but he's obviously very reductive in that approach. But this leads perfectly onto my next subject for you, which is how what you've addressed so far, how this then relates to the problems and the definitions when we talk about free will in a contemporary academic environment.
Yeah. Well, this is a big subject, and I'll say a little bit about it briefly. Now, most philosophers accept a view which I think is just beside the point. It's irrelevant, and that's compatibilism. They think that, yes, we do have free will, but all our acts are still determined, and these are compatible because free will just means that you have acts determined by such things as your character and your decision processing. No doubt they're right that there is a use of free will where if I do things of my own free will, all the same, they might turn out to be determined. But that's not the philosophically interesting question. The philosophically interesting question is, are there cases of action where the antecedent causes of the action were not sufficient to determine that particular action, were not sufficient to fix that action? They were not causally sufficient. And that's the crucial question about free will. Are there cases where when I'm making up my mind to do something, I genuinely have a choice among alternatives? And what that means is that the causes of my action were not at that point sufficient to fix one alternative rather than another. That's the meaningful question of free will, and that is not solved by just saying, well, there are these. There's a use of the word free where if you say he did it of his own free will, it might still be the case that he was determined. That's beside the point. So I think there's a serious question about this. Now, it depends on consciousness, because the only cases where we do have this experience that we act in such a way that our experience is not fixed by the preceding causes, I call that the experience of the gap. There's a causal gap between our sense of the cause of our action and our actually deciding to do something. And these are features of our conscious experience. So the problem of free will is part of the problem of consciousness. Now, we just don't know enough about how the brain produces consciousness or how consciousness functions to know whether or not we do in fact have free will. Are there in fact such actions? But here's an odd peculiarity, and that is even if we become convinced that we don't have free will, we still have to continue to act as if we did have free will, because we cannot engage in rational decision making except on the presupposition of free will. If I go into a restaurant and I'm given a choice of things to eat, I can't say, well, I'm a determinist, I'll just wait and see what I decide or wait and see what happens. Even that only makes sense to me if I think of it as my saying that as part of a free, rational decision-making process. That is, the refusal to exercise free will is only intelligible to us as an exercise of free will. Otherwise, I wouldn't be freely deciding not to exercise my free will. And Kant pointed this out, that we cannot escape the presupposition of free will. Now, that doesn't mean it's true. We don't know enough about how the brain works to know whether or not it's true. But we do know that it's unlike, if it's an illusion, it's unlike other illusions. Because if I think that color is an illusion, I can lead my life on the assumption, okay, these objects look colored, but they're not really colored. It's just an illusion that I have. But I can't in that way lead my life on the assumption that I don't have free will, because whenever I make up my mind to do something, to choose among alternatives, I'm deciding, for example, who to vote for, what to order in a restaurant. In those cases, I have to presuppose that I genuinely have alternatives open to me.
For example, as an illusion, if I were a colorblinded individual, I would look at a color, but be informed that it is another color by someone else, so I take their word on it, but it's an illusion. But at the same time, deciding to talk to you right now or getting in my car in the next 5 minutes is obviously aspect of free will that we may not know if that's deep down an illusion, but we still operate on the assumption that it's
If it's an illusion, it's one we cannot avoid. We can't shake it off. If you insofar as you engage in rational decision making, you have to presuppose freedom. Now, here's an odd feature, and that is that the whole notion of rationality presupposes freedom. Because if rationality is going to make a decision, that is, if rational decision making, whether to believe something or to do something, if that makes sense, then it must be the case that these rational decisions are such that I could have decided to do this, but I also could have decided to do that. So rationality is not the same as freedom, but they have the same subject matter. They're coextensive.
Yeah, they operate within the same framework. I appreciate that. Also, it would be very hard for anyone to kind of at least plan out, execute and organise life, which is kind of a troubling issue as well. Obviously, what we're seeing here is that we're still very much away in terms of neuroscientific research.
Right. And the only sense I think we can really make of the idea, I mean, if the brain were such that we really did have free will, we would have to have a very peculiar explanation of consciousness, whereby the quantum indeterminacy at the level of quantum mechanics, that is partly responsible for the details of our consciousness, and the consciousness inherits the indeterminacy without inheriting the randomness. You see, the standard objection to saying that, well, you can't have a quantum mechanical explanation of freedom because quantum indeterminacy is just randomness, and freedom's not the same as randomness. So you'd have to have an account of consciousness whereby consciousness inherits the lack of sufficient conditions of the quantum level, but doesn't inherit the randomness. Now, I'm not sure that that makes any neurobiological sense, but that's the best I can come up with. We're thinking, well, what would the world really be like if we did have free will? And that's the, given what we know about science now, that's the only way, that's the only thing I can come up with.
Can you take this opportunity, John, if you will, to outline some of the future areas that really need to be concentrated when we're talking about consciousness and what some of your research?
There's so much, but let me tell you several things. First of all, we've got to get clear on the target. And a lot of people talk about consciousness, but it turns out they don't really mean consciousness. Conscious states, by definition, have the following features. For every conscious state, there's something that it feels like to be in that state. That's what I call a qualitative character. The qualitative character of drinking beer is different. The qualitative character of listening to music, and that's true of every single conscious state, is there's something it's like to be in that state, and that's true of doing arithmetic or solving crossword puzzles. Every conscious state has this qualitative character. Now, because of that, they have what I call a first-person ontology. They only exist in humans or animals and maybe other kinds of beasts, but at least we know that they exist in humans or animals. And as I said earlier, they come to us in these unified fields. Okay, now given all of that, we now have to explore all sorts of fascinating questions. And one of them you've just mentioned, namely, granted that we have experience that we call the experience of free rational decision making, is it really like that? Is it really free, or is freedom an illusion? That is, do we have to accept some kind of determinism? And that seems to be an open question. I think there are absolutely fascinating philosophical questions about how consciousness relates us to the world, and in particular in the case of perception. How is it that the phenomenology, what it feels like to have these perceptual experiences, determine what it is that we take ourselves to be seeing? How does the phenomenology fix the content of the perceptual experience? I'm writing a book about that right now. In fact, I think that's a fascinating question. And then, of course, there are a very large number of questions in neurobiology, and there are an awful lot of false things being said in neurobiology. There's currently a view that says, well, really it's just information processing, and information theory is the secret of consciousness. I think that's exactly wrong. It's the same mistake we had in the old days when people said that computers were the key to consciousness. We should think of consciousness as a kind of program running in the brain. And the reason in the case of information is you can't use information to explain consciousness, because you have to have consciousness in order to understand information. Real information of the kind that doesn't depend on any outside observer, that's conscious. That's where I'm consciously thinking something. And the other cases where I have information processing going on my computer, those are cases where some conscious animal or human is using or can use the computer for information processing. So in a word, you can't use information to explain consciousness because you need consciousness to explain information. Same is true of computation, by the way, but I don't know if the computer... I'm militating against the idea that consciousness is just a computer program for 30 years now, and I think it's beginning to have some effect. I don't hear that said so much anymore. Okay, so here are the two general areas of research on consciousness that I see as the most exciting. There are a whole lot of features of consciousness that require further philosophical analysis. I'm writing a book on one of those features, and that is perception. But there are lots of other features. We do not, and this is a scandal, we do not have an adequate theory of the emotions. Mm-hmm. And emotions are paradigmatically conscious. Even Freud thought you couldn't have unconscious emotions because emotions have to agitate you in some way. So I think we ought to have a theory of the emotions, and I can't find one that's any good in the philosophical or scientific literature. They're all pretty bad. So that's another subject matter for a book. I don't know if I'm going to write the book, but somebody has to do the work on the emotions. And there are various other things, such as memory, that need more philosophical work. And, of course, the structure of human intentional action. That, again, requires more philosophical work. I've written a book about intentionality where I had some chapters on that, but that needs more work. So there are two broad areas of research. One is philosophy, and the second is neuroscience. Now, let me add, of course, I don't mean by that to exclude the psychologists, because I think that psychology has important contributions to make. But what is happening, and I welcome this, is that psychology and cognitive science are moving more toward cognitive neuroscience and away from the computational cognitive science. The computer paradigm is giving way to a neurobiological paradigm. So broadly speaking, it seems to me we can divide the exciting areas of research into the scientific areas, roughly speaking, center around neurobiology and neuropsychology and cognitive science, and the philosophical work, which needs to do a more serious analysis of the actual content, the structure of our conscious experiences. Those seem to me very exciting areas, and that can go on for, I think, a long time.
Oh, perfect, John. Thanks. When's the book going to be ready? What's it called? And well, is it likely to be out?
What do you do with publishers? I sent it off to a publisher, and they said, "Well, we'll get back to you in June about what we should do and how we're going to proceed." But I still haven't heard from these guys, and I'm glad you reminded me. I think I'll call them up today and see what's going on.
Yeah, best you do that. It'll be a great read. One more thing, in terms of quantum mechanics, you alluding to there, I just wanted to get your thoughts. Obviously, a problem with this is going to be the ambiguity because of the uncertainty that we don't know yet. But what are your thoughts in terms of the initial stage, and whether this has got any kind of mileage in it in the future? And obviously, I'm alluding to here the Stuart Hameroff and Roger Penrose. Yeah.
Well, okay. Now, there's a general worry that I have is Searle's third law, and that is whenever philosophers talk about quantum mechanics, the result is almost, I won't say the obscene word, but let's say that it's nonsense, or worse, that it's confused. So I'm reluctant to talk about quantum mechanics. By the way, when physicists talk about quantum mechanics, it often comes out sounding pretty nonsensical as well. So I'm very, very reluctant to do this. Now, there are, as you know, and you mentioned one of them, there are people who think, well, quantum mechanics is the secret of consciousness. It ought to worry them that no competent neurobiologist takes them seriously. There are lots of people working on consciousness. Nobody takes the quantum approach seriously. Now, that doesn't mean these guys are wrong, but it ought to worry them that the experimental scientists who actually work on this do not take the quantum mechanical approach seriously. Having said all that, however, I hope they continue the research. I hope they come up with something. But so far, it's very unconvincing. We do not have a convincing quantum mechanical account of consciousness.